Blog Talk. Good morning, Taz. This is a Taz and Paula show, and Taz Powers is on the line with me.
Oh, great. My goodness, here we go, huh?
Well, our guest has not called in yet. I just spoke to him earlier, so I know that here he is. So let me get Nick. It's Nick Begich, and let me put him on the line with us.
Okay.
Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. How is everyone this morning?
Oh, fine. It's much earlier where you're at than where we're at.
Yeah, it's about a little after 10 in the morning here.
Well, we've had you on our show before, and you're one of our favorite guests. We have to say that.
Well,
and Nick has been an author and a citizen of Alaska, and he's actually involved with earth changes, the Arctic and Antarctic regions of the world are being profoundly affected by these earth changes, and you're right there, so you're seeing them right in front of your eyes.
Absolutely. In fact, I've been here since before statehood, and you know, Alaska in the last 50 years has really changed dramatically. I mean, even you know, just right in my own backyard, literally. We grow apple trees here where when I was a kid it was impossible. They wouldn't grow. I mean, you couldn't get anything out of them. And today they do. And it's been a gradual shift that has been noted not just by Western eyes, but by Native Americans throughout the state that historically have very, very long traditional memory passed down about what climate has done. And what is happening here right now is unprecedented. On both extremes. I mean, this last summer, as an example, we had the coldest summer on record for Anchorage, for our area, whereas in other parts of the state, they're having, you know, in the northern region, people read the national press reports of the Arctic Ocean staying unfrozen for a huge amount of time compared to the past. And what is happening is the climate change issue, obviously, and you know, when you aggregate it all, it's warming, but it's causing other changes in terms of jet streams and the way in which currents flow, and that is having a profound effect both in terms of warming and cooling. This summer was the first time in almost 40 years where glaciers in Alaska actually gained a little net mass. In other words, they added more snow than that was melted off during the summer, and that was just sort of an anomaly in this general trend toward global warming.
I know. Changes upcoming that are more in that direction or to a lesser degree?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot more, quite frankly. I think the changes are permanent. They're based on a lot of factors, and there's, you know, certainly there's a lot of public debate still about whether it's, you know, man doing all of this or whether nature is doing a big piece of it. And, you know, my judgment is it's a combination of factors. And right now, man is accelerating or exacerbating an already bad situation that nature has delivered in a couple of ways. For instance, man contributes in terms of greenhouse gases only about 1%. The rest is contributed by nature. And this is important to note. Volcanic eruptions This kind of discharge creates huge amount of particulates and other what we would call pollutants into our environment. And here in Alaska, as an example, the Aleutian Chain is a 2,000-mile-long chain of volcanoes. Right now, there's three of them that have been smoldering for months, in some cases years, on and off. And most folks don't even realize that these are going off because they're so remote from population centers that, you know, you might see the first blip on the radar screen on the 6 o'clock news, and after that you don't hear about them. But they continue to discharge, and this happens all over the world, around the entire Pacific Rim, and throughout other parts of the world.
So is there anything that man can do to help slow this down, or is this just Mother Nature doing her thing?
I don't think we're going to have a very big impact on it. However, the concern that has been, you know, put into play, the politics of global warming, if you will, actually is serving a couple of higher purposes. I mean, beyond, without arguing about who's to blame, the fact is the industrial pollutants that are being poured into our environments are doing other kinds of damage that's clearly articulated now in the record. For instance, the feminizing the species through artificial chemicals that create what turn out to be false hormones that the body begins to react to has caused males essentially to be reducing in terms of percentage of the population in northern regions. We're seeing this first. In fact, there was a great book that was put together by some folks out of MIT and a number of other universities called Our Stolen Future, which dealt with this whole concept. And I had a chance to meet the authors of that and some of the researchers involved in that back in the late 90s in Europe when the work was first coming forward. And there have been numerous reports of chemical pollutants having this kind of effect on various species, creating some huge problems. So, you know, in that sense, those things are important to take into consideration. The other thing is is sort of the natural accelerations. You know, when we talk about sort of the Arctic Ocean staying open for longer periods of time, and people go, well, you know, that's good for shipping or that's good for this or that. Well, what isn't recognized is that the entire northern region of Alaska, Canada, great parts of the former Soviet Union are all under permafrost. In other words, vegetation that has never fully decayed that goes back tens and tens of thousands of years. And permafrost goes down, in some cases, over 1,000 feet and more on the north slope of Alaska, as an example. As you get longer and longer summers, which we do now, what essentially happens is snow reflects sunlight. The ground, of course, absorbs the sunlight, being darker. And what's happening is we're getting increased melting within the permafrost layer that then creates methane gas, which is 20 times or more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. And so it gets released in just incredible quantities that are happening now at an accelerating rate, because what happens is it sort of creates its own cycle. The methane goes in, it makes things even warmer, which means that you have even less snow cover the next year, which then just continues as the years go by to accelerate sort of this cycle now that has kicked in. And this is something that shows up periodically in the media, and whether man started that cycle or not is irrelevant at this moment, because it is engaged and it is going to overwhelm whatever man is contributing to the problem. Volcanic eruption, if you look at the trends on those trend lines, we're seeing a lot more of that. And the other thing that people aren't considering, and I think it's one of the more relevant parts of global warming, is the undersea volcanics. In the ocean, when sunlight strikes the ocean surface, the vast majority of the heat energy in that sunlight is not absorbed, it's reflected away. Very little is absorbed into the oceans, and when it is, it stays at the surface, because as you drop down even just a few feet in the ocean, the temperature gradient drops dramatically, and heat, of course, rises. When you have undersea venting, which is not charted, although we have hundreds, over 1,200 volcanoes charted in the Pacific under the sea, at which time any number of these are going off, except in that case, 100% all of the heat energy is absorbed into the ocean. And if you looked at it from satellite images, they would look like plumes of heat, where they started out small and kind of spread out as the currents took that warm water to different locations, which is exactly how the El Niños appear in satellite images, much different than you would expect from reflected light quickly dissipated off the surface of the seas. So this factor is not being considered. There is a link in some models that the solar activity, which creates energy that then flows to the Earth, not just in the form of heat, but heat that is absorbed and energy that is eventually converted and transformed in some manner. Sometimes some have believed that this also correlates, the sun cycle correlates with volcanic cycles, which incidentally it does when you look at that. So this whole system is interactive in a lot of ways we don't fully understand. But again, when you start to look at what else could contribute to global warming, and the oceans are an incredible heat sink for storing energy released in this manner.
Well, economically, this really could harm us because it's going to change everything. I mean, we have hurricanes and tornadoes and it's hard to keep up with.
Well, you can even go back to our work in the 90s. We did a lot of radio and a lot of print, and we're in the record, and our predictions of what was coming have been dead on right. And it's not based on some mystical crystal ball reading. It's based on evaluating the science and the research and then making some predictions forward. And we said in the 90s, which was the worst year for hurricanes and floods that, you know, ever, and we said, you haven't seen anything yet. And we were correct. I mean, what has happened since is even more so, and I think that trend line continues for the foreseeable future. Now, people are still arguing to some degree about the cause, and many feel like the argument is settled. I don't think that's the case, but I think it's irrelevant at the moment. The more relevant factor is global warming and the climate change conditions that it precipitates, both in some very small regions, the opposite effect, and otherwise. It can no longer be ignored. So the question becomes is, what do you do when all of the models say nothing's going to change for a long time? I mean, even if man stopped everything we were doing, it would take 100 years, if we were fully to blame, to re-equalize systems, according to those models. On the other hand, if it's nature, it doesn't matter what we do, but destroying or adding to the problem is not the answer. So I think the direction we're headed is a good one. The other thing is just to reevaluate our agricultural regions globally and certainly within the United States, because they are shifting. And what we don't want to see is the Dust Bowl phenomena of the 1930s repeat itself because of climate change. We need to look at what's growing in what regions, how the climate is affecting that growth. The citrus line has changed dramatically, as citrus farmers know. The amount of frost they get in the South has changed. Wheat belts in terms of water and requirements there have changed. So we need to start thinking about that and planning forward. Alaska is a big treasury. A lot of people don't know it, but we're 20% of the entire land mass of the United States, as an example. And we have some of the most incredible agriculture possibilities here. We grow the largest vegetables ever recorded anywhere. If you look at the Guinness Book of World Records on those things, you'll find that Alaska has this incredible propensity for growing based on a number of factors, but the soil
must be
a major part.
The soil must be marvelous up there.
Well, you have a combination of really interesting things. You have volcanic dust blowing up from the chain being brought in through the Japanese current into south central and central Alaska. This brings in all of the trace elements in colloidal form into our soils. And then in the south central region of Alaska, where the glaciers existed, there are incredible amounts of glacial silt that are continually churned up in our environment through dust and wind and everything else. So you get all of the trace elements that any living organism could possibly use delivered in the ideal colloidal, which is quite small, form that are easily absorbed through both the root systems in feeding the plant, and also, many people don't know this, but songbirds actually stimulate the pores on the leaves of plants to open and dilate. And so in the mornings, when the dust and the dew have both settled on plants, the dew beads up, it sucks in all that colloidal material, the pores open when the birds sing, and they absorb all those nutrients right through the leaf structures of the plants. So here in Alaska, where you're fed in both ways, it's perfect. And then you have in the summer, of course, the midnight sun, the aggregate number of sunlight hours during the growing season, is significantly greater. So you combine all those factors, and we end up with the most fertile of fertile soils and virgin soils here. So huge potential in Alaska in that regard. And Canada, the Soviet Union, places that weren't considered breadbaskets as such, are going to be reconsidered in the coming decades and should be considered now. The Japanese in the 90s began investing in agricultural rights in Canada based on climate change that did not allow them to grow, and they are very rigid about certain things, to grow in exactly the right temperature and moisture models. So they began acquiring agricultural rights where they don't own the farms, but they direct the manner in which the farming activity takes place so they can replicate what they used to be able to get on the islands of Japan that are no longer possible because of climate change.
Well, they're thinking ahead. That's something our country doesn't do.
No, we do the quarter-by-quarter deal. You know, we say, okay, the market's down this quarter, we better panic. And it's really the long view that is important right now. And it's, you know, we can fight over the politics every day, but let's at least recognize that in the long view, these changes are going to have a dramatic economic impact, both in terms of climate and the disasters that that can create, but more importantly, in food production, which is critical to national security as a foundational building block historically since man first organized communities. But then following that, today in this world, is energy resources, which again are fundamental to this debate. You know, and that's why, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to argue about what's causing global warming so much because it's forcing people to reevaluate fossil fuels and how we utilize them. And I think that's a very, very good thing. The idea of energy independence really ought to be a personal objective. And industry is designed energy dependence, whether it's on another country or whether it's on an energy provider. And this century really should be asking the question, how do we create energy independence for each individual citizen in the way that we used to think about food production? You know, everybody grew their own. In this century, it's not so much about that, but it is about energy, because the amount of energy that consumes a greater and greater portion of our incomes, either directly through utility bills or indirectly through the cost of production and transportation, this is a national emergency. So food, energy, the things that build the foundation of modern society and the cultures that we've developed in the West are dependent on rethinking the old models of scarcity and looking for ways to create abundance in a much more balanced way that makes us stewards of this planet rather than destroyers of it.
Now, your brother is running for Senate.
That's right. He's in a very interesting race up here.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of gossip on the other side. Or not.
Well, I'll tell you, it is indeed. And our senior senator here, Ted Stevens, who has done a great deal for Alaska, I have to say, unfortunately, the most senior Republican in the Congress ever in the U.S. Senate has just been convicted of 7 felonies and has more to come. There's a couple grand juries still seated evaluating some of the other things going on here. Mark has been ahead, my brother Mark, in the polls since the beginning of the race, and it appears that he has a very, very good chance of replacing Stevens in the U.S. Senate.
Now, with you as his brother, I would think that you could bring a lot to Alaska in just the way you've been talking about the agriculture, and that's a whole new frontier to develop.
Well, in Alaska, there's another aspect of this that really deserves more national attention. You know, we're all worried about the economy, and everyone I know that has a 401k is devastated, and many retirees are just devastated. And we're looking at, you know, the debt of the nation has finally gotten everyone's attention and the ramifications of that debt. And, you know, the debt right now in the current portion of the budget, somewhere over estimated to be over $10 trillion in the aggregate obligation, which includes Social Security and those long-term obligations, is somewhere around $60 trillion. And, you know, that's a lot of money in terms of,
sure,
of national wealth. And what no one is doing is taking stock of the assets that represent the balance sheet of the country, if you will, what we own in common, what are the public resources that we own in common. And you hear the Republicans yelling, drill, 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 which, you know, in this particular point in time might not be a bad idea in the right circumstances. But what they're really saying is, sell, 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 because what they're doing is giving away the national wealth at bargain basement prices in this panic mode of emergency when we really should be reevaluating the national treasury on the north slope of Alaska, in the seas off the north slope of Alaska, which incidentally can be drilled directionally. You don't even have to be in the ocean to come underneath it now. You can be 8 miles away. But the point of the matter is that resource, according to USGS, has somewhere between 12 and 36 trillion dollars worth of oil. And that does not include the natural gas. That does not include all the other natural resources that are held on federal lands within the state of Alaska, which would dwarf the obligations of this country in terms of the current portion, the long-term portion of the deficit. And here's the problem, is right now the old model was this sort of wildcatting kind of approach to oil and gas development, where people went in and they said, well, the geology looks good, let's drill here and see what happens. Today we have technologies that have been used by NASA in mapping underground water and other elements in Mars, circulating by a satellite. They can get a couple kilometers deep. Well, here on the Earth, we have what is called Earth-penetrating tomography, which are systems now that can be satellite or otherwise activated, where you get a 99.9% resolution of all the minerals, oil, and gas fields, including their grade and quality, utilizing this kind of mapping, underground mapping. And as a consequence, and this is done by satellites, so you're not like banging the ground and disturbing whales or anything else, you're figuring out where it really is and where it really isn't, which means certainty. And instead of leasing to oil and gas companies these natural resources where they give you a pittance in exchange and sometimes nothing, what we should be doing is keeping that in the private sector but doing it differently. Instead of saying, hey, you guys own the resources, recognizing that the tenant never owns the building. You know, when you rent a building, you own the building. Well, in this case, we rent out the resource, and they act like it's theirs. And what happens if you can quantify the resource, then you can contract out the construction, the drilling, all of those things that belong in the private side, but the American public retains its interest in the underlying resource and receives the full benefit of it, which would change our balance of payments, would alter the way in which this country is shaped. And instead of looking at sort of taking possession of what we already own, we're out nationalizing banks for $1 trillion, which is pure, absolutely corporate socialism. And it's a type of fascism where corporations drive the truck. And we have to recognize that Americans own these underlying resources, and we need to evaluate whether the old models of 1872, the Mining Act of 1872, which still governs mining throughout the United States for most purposes in terms of location and claiming mineral resources, and then the energy laws that came later, and the ability to lease based upon old models and old science and old technology. And these are the kinds of things that hopefully the new Congress will begin to address in terms of technology. Think about technology, its impact on our resources and our things we hold in common, and then let's see how can we maximize for the public benefit those natural resources that can totally change the way this country operates in terms of deficits, in terms of development, and taking a look at those non-renewables from the standpoint of how do we take the wealth of those non-renewables and manage it correctly so that the wealth that comes from that fuels the generation that we need fuel, which is renewable resources that give us energy independence ad infinitum for eternity. And that's the kind of direction that we need to take, is recognize that non-renewable resources are finite. We need to be careful with them, but at the same time, we can use them as a bridge to true energy independence.
So how do we really get started in that direction?
Well, it takes initiative. I mean, certainly public education is a big part of it. You know, as I've started taking on, you know, some of these issues more publicly, you know, we've been known for, you know, our work at Earth Pulse in technology areas. And minerals and natural resources has always been a big part of my interest areas. We just never published much on it. And at this point, it just seems like the critical issue. I mean, we're looking at an economy that if we cannot salvage the U.S. economy, we will, our great-great-grandchildren will never forgive us for the opportunity that we've missed, because we have the opportunity to take it a different direction. It requires taking stock, looking at the balance sheet of the country again, looking at our resources from the standpoint of we all own them, and we decide how we allocate those within the public and private sector. And I'm not talking about, you know, nationalizing these industries. I'm just saying that before we lease another thing, let's decide what we're going to contract out, and let's do it a different. Let's re-rate this system. Let's re-examine these systems. What happened in Denver a few months ago, many people didn't even see it in the news, was the people responsible for oil and gas leases on federal lands and collecting money for the public treasury. They were having sex and drug parties with the oil industry lobbyists and then giving them contracts on the side. They're all being indicted, by the way, and headed for jail. But the point is, how many billions with a B, dollars did the American Treasury lose because of a couple renegade employees that weren't properly policed by an administration that has been so friendly to the oil industry that they're giving away the national treasury? Those are the things that we need to reevaluate. And hopefully, when this administration goes, we'll have an opportunity to do that.
Nick, it sounds like we need to educate people on what's available and what would be best and give them some options.
Absolutely. And I think that's where, again, the opportunity to do that is certainly here. You know, it's a question of will, and, you know, the way the politics really works is it takes pushing something off of sort of the public plate and sticking something on it. And right now, with what is happening in the economy, a lot of things are open for discussions that perhaps could not have happened a few years ago. And, you know, here in Alaska, we have government by endowment, basically. You know, in Alaska, the state government took part of its non-renewable resource revenue stream and put it in a permanent fund that, even though the market is down right now, it has $30 billion in it. We only have 700,000 people here. It earns enough revenue if they wanted to, and if the public agreed to it, the fund earns enough revenue to pay for the entire state budget ad infinitum. It's growing at a rate, and it's because it's growing on our non-renewables, that it could essentially pay the costs of government, both in the operating budget and capital side, forever. We don't have an income tax here. We don't have a state sales tax here. We don't have a state property tax here. We don't have a state corporate income tax here, so you make over $250,000 net. And the reason we don't is because our natural resources pay for the cost of government. And not only do they do that, but this year, every citizen in Alaska received $3,200 from that fund, a little over $2,000 directly from the earnings of the fund, and an additional $1,200 as an energy offset, to offset the increases in cost of energy, and that was funded fully by our state government. And we receive a dividend and have since 1980 every year, and it varies with the earnings of the fund. But there's enough to run the state, there's enough to run that fund, and there's enough to return something to the people that own the resources, us. And I don't think Alaska did enough. I think we could have done a lot more, and had we done it, we would have all of the things that the public is looking for. Only it wouldn't be on the backs of taxation, it would be on the base of the earnings from the funds being generated from the very resources we own in common. What a perfect model. I mean, we get to use our resources, exploit those resources with private companies under regulation, very, very strict environmental regulation, and convert that money that's generated back into investments that generate more in the private sector. So it's a very different kind of approach, but gives sort of citizens a stake in our natural resource base. And as a consequence, we pay attention in Alaska. People pay attention to these issues because they recognize that they're in our own self-interest, where instead, on the national level, they keep increasing our debt load. Our balance sheet for each American now is weighted down by debt that keeps increasing, and the asset side of the equation is never evaluated. And here in Alaska, we evaluated our asset side. We were the last, one of the last two states to be recognized. We were recognized in 59, and we looked at everybody else's mistakes when we created our Constitution and tried to do it a little bit better. And our Constitution in Alaska says that all natural resources will be utilized to the highest and best benefit of the people. And that's an important consideration nationally.
Well, it sounds like an ideal place to live.
It's a great place. It's got its combat politics. I mean, this place has more political action going on than any place I have ever been. And I have traveled all over the world and all over this country because people do care. And we have a very active conservative side and a very active liberal side, which makes sure that we have a good airing of most public debates.
Well, you know, when as a citizen, you think of Alaska as the last frontier, and what we hear, the environmentalists, they think that the oil companies are going to go in and destroy nature. And as Taz said, we need to be educated, saying that we can do this without destroying the nature around it.
Well, and I'll tell you, is if it wasn't for the environmental community, they would. They'd walk right over this place. And it's because of the balance. And that's the American democratic republic that we live in that provides the opportunity to make sure that balance is forged. And so you always have people starting on extreme sides, but the ultimate in the American approach has been, let's find the best way. And usually we get there. Sometimes it's not very pleasant, but eventually we get there. But the goal of looking at these resources as transitional is maybe a little more realistic. And I think people need to be realistic and recognize that, okay, how do we do this if we have to do this so that we don't have to do it anymore? Because no one is going backwards. And we should be setting the stage. You know, if we can find the way to make energy less costly than oil and gas, and that should be our goal, then it's obsolete by market demand and market factors. And that's going to happen. And so now we need to jump on the opportunity to say, all right, to make those changes, it's going to take a lot of industrial changes. And so that's going to take time. In the meantime, let's be smart. Let's use our resources carefully, and let's use them in a way that maybe even retires our national debt obligations, changes our balance of payments, changes our trade relationships, and frees us from the bondage of debt, both as a country and as individuals. That's the hope of the nation. It's not the pessimism and the nonsense being thrown at us to keep us in a state of fear, which shuts down our minds so we cannot consciously make the decisions that human beings were created to make.
Well, it takes Congress. It takes Congress so long.
I was going to say, you know, we've had a couple phone calls from this end, and they really want to know who we're talking to.
Oh yeah, we have to. Dr. Nick Begich.
Yes, and he is the, he's the co-author of the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology, and he wrote Towards a New Alchemy, the Millennium Science. And his latest book, Earth Rising, The Revolution Toward a Thousand Years of Peace. And I was going to say, is there another book that's hot on
the Actually, two more since then. Earth Rising 2 and Controlling the Human Mind, which is on mind-related and brain science. Those books are in several languages, seven languages, five books in print, and nine smaller books called Earth Pulse Flashpoints, and then hundreds and hundreds of articles. And primarily, you know, technology-oriented, although I do a lot of work, as I say, in a lot of areas, you know, so you get a little different perspective on things. But the integration of science and technology, social issues and politics is what we try and do, at least to engage the public debate. We're not always right, although the pattern has been pretty nice and we had a pretty good scorecard. But, you know, it's the idea that we should have this debate, that we should have these kind of discussions and not politicize them, but try and get down to the meat and bones of where we're headed, because we can all make a difference in this thing. And I think that's something that's been realized in the last year or two. With the tough times also comes the recognition of our own individual resilience and willingness to engage again. And I think that's the challenge, is we have to engage our spheres of influence, whether they're our neighbors and our family, or whether some of us are blessed to have even broader spheres of influence. And we need to exercise our right to be heard. We need to think about things carefully, try and remove some of the emotion, and get the facts in front of people that are empowered to make decisions. And I think we can do a lot more of that with some level of optimism, even in these dark days.
Now,
well, my problem with
another conference coming up with the mainstream media and what they won't tell us, and that's coming up November 21st to the 25th. You will be a speaker there. You will lecture. Is that correct?
That's right. That's going to be in Tempe, just outside of Phoenix. I guess it's all Phoenix, really, but the way the community has grown. But we'll be down for that lecture. In fact, we have a lot of information on our website posted where people can go to the lecture section and get the details and find out about that lecture. And that's at earthpulse.com, and you probably have that linked up somewhere on your website. But EarthPulse, P-U-L-S-E, earthpulse.com, will have that information for folks.
And you have a lot of articles that are great.
Right. We post a lot of free material there. There's a lot of articles. There's hundreds and hundreds of pages of data on the website. We have about 90 hours of free audio radio programs that we've done in the past that are on the website. We have some free video on the website. And, of course, if you pick something up every once in a while, that helps us keep doing the work that we're doing. So we really appreciate it when people take a look at our books and videos and publications that we do charge for and support us in that way.
Now, you've studied quite a bit of Tesla's technology.
Right.
And
right. This is pretty exciting stuff, too.
And that there's a lot of free energy in his technology, isn't there?
Absolutely. In fact, I have all of his published papers, all of his articles, all of his patents. And his main deal was, you know, when you really look at it, it's about alternating fields and resonance, figuring out ways to sort of capitalize on energy that might be otherwise not available. And so it's sort of, it's not like tapping a zero point or energy out of nothing. It's there's actual a cause and effect relationship that you can look at. And when you think about transferring energy or pulling energy off of a natural system, which is really what Tesla was trying to do, he had developed a system where you could plug in with an antenna rather than a power line into a power system that would allow you to, you know, light your home and energize your life, essentially. And he saw it as a wireless transmission. He was a guy that developed AC current, alternating current. He beat out Edison. People never know about Tesla, but, you know, Tesla, I think the only real monument to him is at Niagara Falls because it was built as the first AC, major AC power generation system when Tesla won out because you didn't need, you could essentially send energy over very long distances without having stations every few miles, and this made his technology much, much better. But he continued to work on how to get over distance. Then, of course, you get line loss because of resistance in the lines and just loss in the lines. So energy, as further you get away, the less energy is available. And so he was looking for ways to make energy more efficiently transmitted so you would not have these energy losses. And he developed several theoretical models, but unfortunately he didn't write them down. But he did develop hardware that exploited a number of these things. Radio. The first radio was actually him, not Marconi. He eventually won a U.S. Supreme Court decision in this. Unfortunately, it was like a year before he died. It didn't do him much good. He also did the first remote control, a radio control boat that was done in New York and documented. He had a number of very good ideas along this line. And in fact, there's been many other scientists since that time that have new ideas in energy generation transmission that are being looked at, even as simple as hydrogen. You know, 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, MIT announced a new cell that would produce the equivalent of hydrogen if gas were $3 a gallon in terms of or per BTU. So $3 a gallon gas equaled the same BTU output of a volume of hydrogen through this cell. Now, that was 3 years ago. This technology is going to continue to advance until the point where the energy equivalent is about a buck. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could all get back to that? And maybe even less, because if you look at some of the catalytic materials, see, the industry is gearing for a hydrogen economy. That means you still pull into a filling station and buy a gallon of milk and get your hydrogen, when in reality, what could be designed, and probably will be outside of the United States where it's more in people's a national interest that isn't corrupted by corporate lobbyists, they're going to develop this where you can use things like sodium borohydrate, which is a catalytic material that if you electrolyze water within the presence of these catalytic materials, you can produce hydrogen much more economically, and you can recycle the sodium sodium borohydrate or other materials that act as catalysts. That's where the science is going to get more interesting, is when we start to crack hydrogen sort of on board, where the only thing you need is at home, you need a water filter, which most people have these days, and then you pour distilled or purified water into your tank and away you go. And that's where we get energy independence, not pulling into the gas station, into somebody's infrastructure. The reason that the big oil companies now are investing so heavily in, first, they made a fortune, so they have the money to invest because they've been robbing us royally on oil prices. But look at what they've banked in cash. Now they're buying up the industries that are going to create the next energy monopoly, and instead of creating the next energy level of independence where we don't need them, where every home is equipped with its own power generation system, that it might even net out a little bit to contribute to the grid for those industries that require higher levels of energy. That kind of forward thinking, that kind of national goal should be in every industrialized nation, because that then gives us about a third of our economy back in cash. If we don't have to buy energy, we don't have to produce energy in the traditional ways that we've done it, all that money gets freed up for other aspects in the economy, whether it's healthcare, education, water and sewer systems where they're needed, smokestack suppression for the chemical pollutants that are coming out of the industrializing world, because there's money available to take care of those things. We need to re-examine all of it, and not from a corporate perspective, but from a perspective of what can we apply in our technological base today to free us individually as human beings tomorrow. And this generation is at the crossroads of making those determinations.
We need to get rid of lobbyists.
Well, it would be a good start. You know, it would sure be nice to be on an equal footing with them, at least, where we could walk into our congressional offices and have lunch. But unless you're writing a big check, I got to tell you, it's not going to happen. And all of that system of industrial corruption has resulted. I mean, here in Alaska, we got 11 people that have already been indicted or confessed that are headed for jail. These are major lobbyists and now six elected officials. And cleaning up the system from that perspective, and then holding companies, this is something that we tried to push forward here. And it's a nice piece of legislation that probably ought to happen someday. And it's when these companies bribe, get caught bribing people to get political outcomes that then cost the American public money, you know, and you can articulate that money. Like here in Alaska, the corruption resulted in a $1.1 billion loss to the state treasury, directly attributed to the bribe that took place. The guy that placed the bribe had $300 million in assets. And my view is we should have sued him for our loss in the public interest and recovered at least whatever he had that corrupted our political system. You start creating those kinds of laws that grab people's assets, because that guy's going to jail, but he gets to keep his money. Now, there's something wrong with that. And this country starts holding corporate officers personally liable and corporately liable, where all of their nice little trimmings in life disappear and they start over. People would make much different decisions, and they would be in the public interest. But we need legislation that holds people accountable and rewards people for blowing the whistle on corruption. And maybe we even need a very narrow bandwidth moratorium where we allow people the opportunity to come forward and confess and clean up their mess and be forgiven and not be prosecuted. And then the day after that thing ends, they go to jail if they don't come forward. That's what South Africa did after their non-revolution and changing their way of life. They allowed an amnesty period, people to confess so the truth could come out and you could sort of have a cleansing. We need that in this country. We need a lot of things in this country to reshape so people can blow the whistle on corporate officers that are shuffling the deck and jeopardizing our futures as retirees, and at the same time hold government accountable when they play that game with corporations or individuals. And we need a whole new system. Technology gives us the opportunity, instead of looking into the public, we need to look into government, look into corporate activity, and find out how it's corrupting this democratic republic, because these technologies have had 200-plus years to emerge since the founding of the nation and have not been looked at against the screen of what is in our individual interests as Americans.
I know the auto industry, all of a sudden, they go, whoa, people don't want big trucks.
Well, and here's again a lack of forward thinking. You know, those people that look at, and why? Because look at the boards of directors of these corporations, and you will find that they have similar board members are also sitting on the boards of oil companies. You will have the same ones. So it is their interest to push big trucks that consume big oil. You can go back to when Ford and Edison and all those boys back in the turn of the century, the last century, would get together and sort of map out the future. And they still do it, only they do it on a much more sophisticated level. You have the same board members on auto manufacturers, oil companies, and so it's in their interest to promote certain things, and that's reflected in their products. In other countries where survival matters more and public interest has a little bit more bearing and maybe integrity has a higher level, that doesn't happen in the same way. So you get the innovations coming from Japan for energy because they have no natural resources to speak of. So they use innovation. And we used to be the innovators, and we're not anymore because instead of innovating for the future, we're trying to hang on to the past by letting this old corporate model pull us right down in so many ways. I mean, this country has lost in so many ways, and not because our system is wrong, but because the accountability has not kept up with the changes that have taken place in our lifetimes, our parents' lifetimes, and our grandparents' lifetimes now.
Now, I'm going to shift gears a little bit here. Is there anything new with HAARP?
Well, you know, the HAARP program continues to get funded. In fact, Ted Stevens was her biggest advocate for getting money to that program. You know, it is a huge project, you know, now in Alaska, but not just in Alaska. The technology has been exported and is being utilized by other countries developing similar systems. And it was a developmental prototype. That's what it was intended to do. And at this point, it's at half of its intended array size. It's at 180 antennas in the array. When we published our book, there were only 48. So that's an ongoing project, continues to get funded. And again, it's one of those that, you know, it has some interesting research applications, but there's incredible risk associated with it as well. The inventor, Dr. Eastland, died in 2007. He had become a pretty good friend of mine over the years. And at the point in which he was passing, he actually, just a few months before, he was in a conference where we had a chance to film his presentation on HAARP, and it's actually free. It's on earthpulse.com, E-A-R-T-H-P-U-L-S-E, earthpulse.com. You can go to the mind effects section, and we did it in the context of that subject matter, but he covered a number of areas regarding HAARP and some of his big concept ideas. So you can see that there, and you can also see it at the Lay Institute, LayInstitute.org.
Now, does the military use HAARP?
It is now controlled by DARPA. It was a Navy and Air Force project originally. It transferred over to DARPA around 2003, and they do the defense research for all the branches of the military. They don't do research just for pure science. They do it for military applications. Once DARPA takes a project, it pretty much drops down a level in terms of public disclosure. So there's not as much coming out. In fact, there's very little coming out of that planning group at this point. The only thing that we see is, as you search HAARP on the military Google search engines, because now they're separate, then you can find where the other branches are starting to utilize it for some research applications.
Now, do they ever use it for weather change?
That, there's no independent monitoring. Certainly it can be utilized in that way. In fact, before Eastland passed on, he had determined that HAARP could modify weather with 1,600 times less energy than he originally anticipated. And the reason he felt that way, and you'll see it on his video, is you could actually affect gravitational waves. And if you could, and he felt the gravitational waves, based on his research, had a relationship to weather systems. So if you affect the gravitational waves, you could then affect massive changes in weather systems. And so in that sense, he became very concerned. In fact, he said to me that he would not share his research, his new research on weather modification, unless it was in the forum of an open scientific international project where it wasn't military controlled, because he was so concerned that the advances would create an environment of temptation that the military couldn't let go of. And the result of that is global chaos in terms of weather systems. If countries start to do this, and they are. In fact, the Congress addressed this, or tried to address it a couple years ago, to regulate private use of weather modification technology because there's no regulation. And the science is now becoming flat enough where that is a legitimate concern. There's actually companies offering weather modification technology to get you some rain in your cornfield. And that might get you your problem solved, but might create a problem downwind that is unanticipated and disproportionate to what you originally put in terms of energy. And these kinds of relationships with weather and modification of weather, there's permitted under international treaty to modify the weather within the boundaries of your country, but if it crosses boundaries, it violates these international protocols. And the thing about weather is it doesn't respect artificial lines drawn on some map. It doesn't understand that. Weather moves according to factors that have nothing to do with you and I to the greatest degree. But when you start manipulating them, then you have unanticipated consequences. And if you say you get rain in your country, but the country next door all of a sudden goes through a drought, they're going to be pretty angry about that. These are the things that have to be considered in the backdrop of technology in this century, is the things that can stimulate warfare are those very things that we need to be cognizant of. And in terms of this technology, the military has said in their published material, they would love to have the highest state of the art in this area, because if they could control the environment, they could wage war without you ever knowing it. They just turn off your ability to they set up an embargo and then turn off your ability to grow food. You know, kind of like North Korea for the last decade or so. You know, was that artificial? Who knows? Certainly odd.
I know some people think that it's not just by the act of nature. And the tsunami, some people think, well, it was increased by man.
And the idea there is that, you know, you already have a lot of energy, and so one of the things, and I talked to Eastland about this, and the amount of energy to have an effect on a hurricane is huge. It could not be produced by HAARP alone. But having said that, HAARP is a system that can also trigger through resonance the releases of natural energy. And this is something that came up at Stanford University when these transmitters were used for broadcasting VLF, very low frequency, into the upper ionosphere. And what happened, because of resonance, energy that was already there got released, and the signal increased by 1,000 times in terms of intensity. So it's not like it brought energy out of thin air or out of nowhere in this case, but it brought it out of, it triggered it. It caused it to be released. I'll give you an example of a similar kind of idea. If we took dominoes from here to Paris, from Alaska to Paris, and we started with a regular size domino, and we increased it by just 1% in terms of size and weight with each one. By the time we got to Paris, there'd be a great big one there about the size of the Eiffel Tower. But here we are in Alaska, and I just tap that first one with a 5-gram weight. And then they all tumble down, and by the time you get to the one in Paris, the size of the Eiffel Tower, it falls down and crushes the Eiffel Tower. Now, was it the 5 grams that triggered that event? No, it was the gravitational energy that it picked up along the way, if you follow me.
It's like a wave that just increases and gets larger as it goes.
Right, and so here you have a system that can trigger releases of energy that is otherwise not available. And this is what the key to this system is. It is designed to manipulate the geophysics of the planet. It's like a control mechanism that's designed to directly influence these otherwise pretty rigid systems in nature. And it acts as sort of a trigger mechanism, like the primer on a bullet, releasing the greater energy in the gunpowder behind the primer. Think of those kinds of analogies when you think about HAARP. It's not so much how much energy is involved, although it's huge. It's how that energy is used to trigger releases of larger amounts of energy otherwise unavailable to us.
Put it in the wrong hands and we're in trouble.
Exactly, which is why these kinds of projects belong, if they're going to happen at all, in the open public sort of view, where we can have a little more discussion. You know, HAARP is one of many technologies. And the reason people focus on it is because several of us as researchers took it on Because we saw it not just in terms of its own ramifications, but sort of as a marker along the way, where we have to start to ask ourselves, much in the same way as thermonuclear nuclear power was developed, we need to look at this and say, where do we go, what do we do, and how do we evaluate it, and should we do this in public? And on these big technologies, absolutely every time.
Well, if we have something like HARP, other nations must have something similar, I would think.
Russia has the system. Europeans, through the ISICAT system and their cooperation, have these systems. China actually announced their own systems a couple years ago in response to ours, and they're developing not in the Arctic, but in the Antarctic on their installations there. So no one's ignoring this. It's just not usually on the mainstream, although you'll see it. Wired Magazine has something scheduled in the next few months, a pretty in-depth story on HARP, and hopefully, from all indications, it will be quite balanced.
Paula,
so let's look forward to that.
Yes. Paula and Nick, we've got about 3 minutes left. If there's anything you'd like to share with us that we haven't touched upon, Nick, would you go ahead and do that?
Well, let me make sure I give my contacts again, if I can. The Earth Pulse site, for those that have Internet access, is great. We also have a free catalog of books and publications. I can give you a toll-free number for people who are interested in that, and that toll-free number is 888-690-1277. Again, that's 888-690-1277. And I just encourage people to look at that information. Any of the things that they get from us, when they're done with them, pass them to somebody else. Or if you don't have these in your library collections locally, contribute them to your libraries, because you never know who's going to run across this material, and you never know. Send it to your U.S. senator, for goodness sake. Give them a chance, somebody on their staff a chance to look at this material. It's extremely well documented. The books that we currently have in print, we have four. 1,650 sources are referenced there, an incredible catalog of reference material that gives people the science sort of behind these concepts in a very clear and delineated way. So I just encourage people to get the material, learn a little bit about this if it's of interest to you, and carry it up. Get it to public officials that can make a difference. And let's not give up. It's election year. We're in the last week of a very exciting year. And at the same time, one filled with peril. Let's change our direction and recognize our own potency as individuals and start to act on what we know to be right and true. Doesn't mean we're going to win every battle, but it means that we're going to engage it, and we're no longer powerless, just being beat around by circumstances. But we can actually take control of some things that are within our spheres of influence and begin to act in our own interest, in the interest of those we have not met yet, our great-great-grandchildren. And if we focus there, we can forget, we can let go of a lot of our daily conflict and optimistically look forward to the future. And that's what this country needs right now. We do not need more doom and gloom. We need to rise above it, recognize who we are as human beings, and begin to act as the created creatures that we are.
We
thank
well
you for being the icing on the cake today. It definitely is allowing us to have a new vision. And that's what we do need, Nick, and we love to have you with us each time because of this.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it, and any time that we can continue to give an update on what's happening, we certainly are available to you.
Great. It's been a real pleasure.
So you've contributed to a lot of people learning more of what's happening, so that's very important, and thank you for your time.
Well, thanks for having me, and we'll look forward to the next program.
Okay, will do.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Taz and Paula Show, and hope that you can come on to our website and listen to our archives. So it's tazandpaulashow.com, and we have archives there that you can listen to and a lot of nice articles.
Yes. Thank you for being with us today, and we'll be right back. This is 91.5 FM KKUP Cupertino, Embracing Mother Earth is the name of our program, and I'm Taz Powers. And very soon we will have our next program up for you, and you'll be able to contact us again at the TazAndPaulaShow.com.